It may be invisible to some or ever present to others, but trauma entangles us all. Welcome to Traumatize, brought to you by Volare. Traumatize is a podcast that creates space and conversations to untangle the societal knots that keep us from addressing trauma after crime. For you, we want this podcast to be an experience, one where you leave understanding how you can be a crossing point to minimize the deeply painful and costly consequences of trauma, no matter who you are.
Welcome back to Traumatize, where we believe trauma is a common thread of the human connection. I'm Bridget Stumpf, and as always, I'm here with my co-host, Lindsay Silverberg.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Traumatize, where we explore survivorship, community caretaking, and the evolving science of healing. Today, we're honored to be joined by Dr. Jazz Robbins, a licensed psychologist, board-certified holistic nutritionist, professor, author, and performing artist whose work sits at the powerful intersection of trauma, therapy, nervous system regulation, nutritional psychology, and creative expression. Dr. Jazz describes her clinical approach as an active experience because healing isn't something that we passively receive. It's something we practice and build, skill by skill, in real life. In this episode, we'll talk about how trauma can hijack the nervous system, make rest, joy, connection, and even basic functioning feel out of reach, and how Dr. Jazz helps people return to themselves through sustainable tools that integrate mind, body, nourishment, and art. Welcome, Dr. Jazz. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Hello. I am so excited and happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So your work really uniquely bridges this psychology, holistic nutrition, expressive arts, all these paths. I think that in the work that Bridget and I do, we don't often get to see in traditional trauma spaces. And we'd love to know a little bit about your pathway into this integrative work, if you don't mind telling us.
Yeah. So I tell folks all the time, present day, that I'm an actor cosplaying as a psychologist. I'm here. I've done the work. I have the schooling, the knowledge, and the credential, all of those things. But I'm a performer at heart. So I've been in dance class since about 3 years old. Since I could walk, I was in dance class. And I danced from a tiny tyke through college. And then I was also performing in theater. Those were my outlets. Those were the avenues through which I expressed pain, joy, and all of the things. I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time, but those were definitely my spaces and my outlets. As an undergraduate, I majored in biology with the intention of going to medical school. And as an elective, my first year, I took a nutrition course. It sounded interesting. Dr. Ash was her name. I remember that class like yesterday. For the first time, I couldn't wait to get to class. I wanted to stay late. I was coming early. And what about? And what about? And what about? And different from physics and calculus that you're oftentimes told, oh, you'll use it at some point, or you'll use it later, or you'll see how it makes sense later. In my nutrition course, that very first course, I was able to go home and make changes and apply it immediately. I was able to tell family and friends things immediately. Everything made so much sense to me. And I went to an advisor to see if I could change my major. I ended up changing my major to food science and nutrition. I was a nutritionist working privately after graduation. I birthed a one-woman show and I was touring that East Coast, lived in New York for a bit, was abroad. Because I'm a trauma survivor, this particular show, which is called Stepping on a Few Toes, it's autobiographical in nature, telling my story from about 6 years old through undergrad. And I'm telling my story of pain and healing. And the way that audience members connected with the material, the story, the content, the characters that I portrayed was so profound. For years, I was met with, intense tears, just even thinking about it right now. The intensity of that reaction, those reactions were because they saw that person in their lives. That was my mom. That was my abuser. I think I was date raped. These were the comments that I would get from folks after shows. But after performing stepping on a few toes for so many years and having this reaction, it started to feel like I wasn't doing right by the audience. So I said, you know what, after this run, I'll pause and see if I can link up with mental health care services. Maybe there's a therapist that can come and sit here for these talkbacks, or if I could get pamphlets or brochures or business cards, something to put in the lobby. And I heard the tiniest whisper in my ear. In my apartment in New York where I lived alone, I heard the tiniest whisper in my ear that said, "Why can't that be you?" And I'm like, "Me? What? Go back to school? Debt? Are you?" Like, it seemed like the farthest thing from anything that would make sense for my life. But that's what I did. That's what I did. I said, "Okay, God, if this is what you want for me, I'm applying to one school. Get me in or don't get me in. That's it. All right, I did my master's, and then I'll apply to one doctoral program. Get me in or don't get me in." Got in, got a scholarship. I'm like, okay, fine. I'll do it. So that's how it sort of came to be. And I knew that if I was going to go on this academic journey, that there had to be a way. Either I was going to invent it, or there had to be a way for me to pull this nutrition piece in. Again, I didn't know at the time that there was so much science already established, so much literature already there around the connection between nutrition and mental health. There's a discipline called nutritional psychology. They were waiting for me, right? A family of scientists and researchers and professionals that were already waiting for me. And that's how I was able to get into that space. And in terms of expressive arts, through my schooling, my master's and my doctorate, again, I saw research and literature and studies that discussed therapeutic and the healing impacts of music, of storytelling, of movement, of dance, of all of these things. And I was like, oh, no wonder I felt like home in those places, because home life was chaotic, but dance class was always fun. Dance class was always a place that I could release and feel like myself. I am fortunate to be in this professional space that allows me to pull on all of those pieces, and I don't have to divorce myself from any of it.
That's incredible. We actually had a really interesting conversation last season on the podcast with an actor who's on Broadway, and he is really like studying the psychology of storytelling and the impact that that has on the actual storyteller. But I see so many connections between the incredible work that you're doing and just the, what he would talk about how it was this really beautiful way to talk through trauma, to deal with and resiliency. So it's very cool. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And I had the same exact connection. I was like, it's so amazing when people are able to both have the lived experience of like, wow, this is really healing for me. But then you're hearing from the audience, like, this is also healing for me. And that transformative experience you had where you were like, okay, there's something here that's really connecting with people. It's something we get to see in these conversations. That's been really beautiful. And one of the things, Dr. Jazz, this season that we're trying to explore a little bit more is this idea of how trauma often takes root sometimes in invisible spaces. So early in our biology, in development, subtle cues long before we really even have the language, right, to understand and describe what we had experienced. And you sort of talked about that, like dance was the place I would go, but I didn't really understand necessarily why it was giving me something that was probably safe and just like healing. And so from your perspective, how do you see trauma showing up in the nervous system, in the body, even when people maybe can't point to a particular event? And why is understanding that sort of invisible space that sometimes we hold it, why is that so important for people to understand?
So the nervous system, in my opinion, I am a nervous system sort of, that is the soapbox that I live, die on, breathe in the work that I do with my patients in therapy. I'm aiming to balance their nervous system as opposed to targeting a single symptom, sleep or something, because I know that when the nervous system is balanced, all of those other symptoms will dissipate. As an infant, I could go so many directions, so many places. Dr. Peter Levine is a trauma specialist, and he talks about working with a toddler and mom. The mom is just having some challenges calming the toddler. So Dr. Levine gets the mom and the toddler together. He tells the story about sort of like having the toddler on his lap, standing upright. And when the toddler got agitated, aggravated, he was like kicking and thrusting his feet, almost like stomping, but like in a really sort of violent way. And fast forward, I won't take you through all of the details, but the mom tells the story of during labor, the umbilical cord was wrapped around the infant's neck. This thrusting that we were seeing in toddlerhood was mimicking that sort of, I'm distressed and I'm trying, you know, to soothe myself in some way. We can go all the way back there. Like we can go all the way back there. I always ask, and I encourage mental health care providers to ask their patients their birth story if they know it, because there's things in the birth story that are showing up unknowingly, and that can serve as such good validation for individuals who may say things like, I don't know why I such and such, or I've just always dot, dot, dot. But when we are arm babies, the brain is just ready and waiting to be imprinted on. There's lore about the University of Southern California at Irvine, the Irvine campus, I'm told. I haven't researched to see if it's true or not, but I'm told that when the campus was first built, they didn't put in sidewalks. They allowed the student body to just like walk naturally. And where those paths were, they then laid sidewalk there. Our brain is waiting for pathways to be laid. And when we are in relationship with our primary caregivers, either those pathways are this happens and this leads to joy, this happens and this leads to peace, this happens and this leads to calm, this happens and this leads to safety, or it's something else. And that's happening here. So fast forward, like to use myself as an example, recently dealing with distress in the home and home repair and things of that nature. And I was in a meeting and someone said, my goodness, well, you are happy and smiling and you'd never know. And in my mind, I said, you're seeing a trauma survivor show up and do the trauma thing that a trauma survivor knows how to do. Right. So in chaos, in disruption, especially when someone has experienced those things in childhood, the learned survival behavior in an attempt to calm that nervous system is bottle it up, hold it up by any means necessary, because there is not safety here. There is not safe connection. There is not calm. There isn't emotional validation that's happening with any of the primary caregivers in my sphere of influence right now. So I have to sort of do that for myself. It's a survival technique that works in childhood and maybe even in teenhood and early adulthood, but it works until it stops working, right? And so it becomes maladaptive. At one point it was protective, and then it can become maladaptive when the stressors are no longer there, but I've not learned how to calm, to exhale, to allow others to enter my life, to enter my space, to allow relationship, to allow comfort, to allow safety. When folks are making attempts to give and provide that to me, for some, it can feel incredibly foreign and incredibly uncomfortable. They find themselves in their 40s, 50s, maybe 60s, trying to grapple with, my friends say that I keep them at arm's length. My best friends say that I keep them at arm's length. You know, all of that is, it's nervous system work. It is truly nervous system work.
Wow. That's incredible. I got chills about that story with the umbilical cord. Like, it is one of those things that makes so much sense when you say it, of like, of course that would have an impact, right? But I don't think people spend a lot of time in sort of everyday life conversation talking about or even thinking about those things. So I'm just really thankful that you're sharing all of this. And one of the unique lenses that we've been really excited to talk to you about that you bring to trauma work is this nutrition piece, right? And I think for many people, they don't immediately connect food and nourishment and trauma. Can you talk about how trauma impacts our relationship with food in the body and how nourishment can become a tool for regulation and healing?
I like to say things like, or just sort of bring common colloquialisms to this conversation, things like, I had a gut feeling, or something in my gut tells me, or before XYZ, I had butterflies in my stomach. All of those things that we just sort of say, and we're talking about some sort of sensation in the abdominal space or in the torso space as it relates to an experience or an event, there's science there that is telling us that there are experiences and events that can activate, disrupt, help to calm sort of like our gut space. So zoomed way out, there's a large body of literature that says that we kind of have two brains, this brain in our head and a second brain in the gut, which is the gut microbiome. So the brain in our head weighs, if you were to put it on the scale, about 3 pounds. If you took all of the bacteria in the gut biome, if you were able to sort of knot them all together and put them on a scale, they weigh about 3 pounds. And these two brains talk to each other via the vagus nerve. So there's direct communication going from here to here all day long. And what we put into our body has an impact on what is being communicated. When someone has experienced trauma, it can be common. Let's pull it back a little bit and let's just say stressful situations. Let's go with that. When someone has experienced stress or is in distress, it is common for the body to crave sugar. It's common for the body to crave salt. It's common for the body to crave fat. These are oftentimes soothing in some way, right? Oh my, I had a bad day. I need my chocolate. Oh, I had a bad day. I want some mashed potatoes. I had a bad day. Mine was, I want some mac and cheese. There's something like if we were to, I do a food diary with my folks just to find threads and trends. I was irritable that day. I ate such and such. I was calm and happy that day. I ate such and such. I was stressed out that day. I ate such and such. And that simple act of just equating food and mood, just that food and mood. What I ate this, this was my mood. Just looking at that can tell an individual so much about themselves and their personal relationship with food. I have a lot of my patients do a food autobiography and just sort of like cataloging their relationship with food from childhood to teenhood to adulthood. And that gives them information, right? So on the one hand, we have a large body of research and science that tells us, you know, things on a cellular level, what's happening in terms of neurotransmitters and all of those things. And that might not be useful for a patient that I'm working with. However, when I can have them or give them the space or the opportunity to write their food autobiography and to do a food mood journal, and for us to just get curious and let's see what's happening here, that can be incredibly eye-opening for them. And it can give them the motivation to eat more mindfully without judgment, without, you know, having to sort of say awful things and bad things about myself. When we're talking about, particularly with trauma survivors, life, a perpetrator or a lived experience has already sort of piled on and dogged us out. We don't need to take that baton from that person or that experience and say, now I'm going to be the one beating myself up. Even that's a conversation that I'm having with a lot of the folks that I work with. But yes, I know I went around the river and through the woods. There's definitely a connection, and it's important to bring sleep into the conversation as well, because sleep gets quite disrupted when someone has experienced trauma. And if sleep isn't regulated, nutrition will never be regulated. You're chasing a moving dart or board if you're not targeting sleep first, because that's the foundation.
Yeah, this is interesting because Lindsay and I were just talking about how the last couple of nights have been hard for us to sleep and how both our lives and the external world impact how we feel the next day after sleep is disrupted. And you actually brought up something really personal for me around the connection with our relationship with food. And I just wanted to quickly share, when my son was born, we actually lost our first child, and then I got pregnant and I delivered her in the third trimester and then got pregnant with my son the next month. So it was in 1 year had delivered two babies, and he came later in the year. And when we were about to deliver him, we found out he had this heart condition. And so they transferred us to a different hospital where he could be born and potentially get heart surgery to correct this issue. And, you know, they're describing to us like the size of a baby's heart and how they'll do that. And so when he was born, for the first 2.5 days, they wouldn't let him eat anything because they were monitoring him for open heart surgery. And so I was pumping and saving my colostrum. And we joke now, he's totally fine. And it was a really traumatic experience, but went as well as you could possibly hope for in the outcome. But he loves food and like his relationship with food, it's actually really beautiful. He's like a mini Ratatouille. Like he'll like be like a food critic of everything that we make. And I so deeply believe it is tied to his inability to have food on those like initial days. And I sort of jokingly tell him this story that it's like, you know, all his love of food is because of this deprivation, but I really think there's like something there. And so it's just like a really personal way that what you were describing comes up for me. And I'm just so profoundly grateful, not only Dr. Jazz for you talking about your own personal experience as a trauma survivor, but you have done some really profoundly healing work in communities that are really vulnerable to trauma exposure. And I just really appreciate that. And it's something that we think a lot about in the work we do around how do we take the reality of how, you know, common trauma exposure is in communities and then move that towards our capacity for resiliency and support community resiliency. And you've really, I think, operated at kind of this intersection of science and innovation as it relates to creative approaches to healing. And I'm curious what you see as some of the most promising or maybe underutilized directions that we can start to think about that are maybe more non-traditional, but really have profound benefits around resiliency and healing for individuals and communities.
Yeah, I think, let me first ask a clarifying question from the perspective of lay individuals or from the perspective of mental health care or healthcare professionals?
That's a good question. So I think for our audience, I would be interested in the science-y answer, the mental health piece, but I think for the folks that we're hoping are listening, it's folks that maybe this isn't a part of their normal conversation. So more of that lay person lens.
Yeah. If they can think about, if you can hear the sound of my voice, think about your nervous system in terms of a traffic light. So when, you know, a traffic light has three lights, green, yellow, and red, and when you drive, when you're the driver and you're driving through an intersection and the light is green, there's calm, there's a sense of safety, there's a low sense of threat or danger. You might be singing along to whatever you're listening to. You might be doing full-on choreography. There's a sense of peace. Versus when the light is yellow, whether you do it physically in your body or not, there is this bit of hypervigilance that I need to scan the perimeter. I need to really pay attention to what's happening because the threat of danger has increased. And then in the red light intersection, we're actually disengaged from the act of driving. We're probably not even touching the steering wheel at that point. Very stop and shut down. If we use those three states to think about nervous system, green light in the body is the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. And that's when our body is in a state of rest and digest. That's when you feel most like yourself because every system in the body is operating at peak performance. That's the integumentary system, the nervous system, the muscular system, the skeletal system, the digestive system, the reproductive system, all of the systems are running at peak performance. So you feel like yourself, you feel an urge to connect with others, you feel an urge to do the things that bring you joy. Versus when you're in yellow, that's an activation of the sympathetic nervous system. That's the fight flight. Digestion literally stops. So when I meet someone that say that they struggle with things like chronic constipation, I know this person has been in yellow for a long time. The body was only meant to be in yellow for a short period of time. And in yellow, it's that space where a mom can lift a car off of her spouse or her child because the fight flight response, the stress response system in the body is literally stealing resources from every other system so that you can see sharper than you typically do, so that you can hear better than you typically do. However, when the body stays in that yellow space for a long period of time, because it's greedy and it's stealing resources, that's when we might develop back pain, acne, hair challenges, all, you know, body aches and pains. When you go to the medical physician and they say, the tests look normal, the only thing that I can do is it may be stress. This is what they mean. This is what they mean. And they say, lower your stress or deal with stress, but they don't give you tools for that. If we can think about that in terms of yellow, green, and then red, red is when I've been in yellow for far too long, and now my body is zapped of resources because the yellow has stolen everything from everywhere. So that's an overactivation of the sympathetic nervous system. In red, you might be at home, see a sock on the floor, and you know what? I don't even have the energy to deal with that. And it's not that you can't physically bend down and pick it up. It's that you internally don't have the energy to do something with it after you've picked it up. The dish in the sink stays there. We're disengaged from life, as it were, at that point. So if individuals can think about their nervous system in those terms and really identify and pinpoint the things that promote green for them, it could be playing with my dog. It could be looking at the sunrise or sunset. These are things that folks refer to as self-care or self-love, or I refer to them as self-maintenance, because just like changing the oil in your car, we do that so that the check engine light doesn't come on. We do that so that there isn't a vehicular crisis. We need to be doing things for ourselves so that our check engine light doesn't come on. Just the same way when the check engine light comes on, that car is expensive to repair and it's inconvenient. When our check engine light comes on, we are expensive to repair and it's inconvenient. So if we're doing something from that green light space every single day, and it can't be, you know what, when I was in Italy that summer, man, I was at such peace. We can't go to Italy every day, but there has to be, maybe I can listen to Italian music every day. Maybe I can watch an Italian show every day, right? What are the things that I can do every day that give me contact, even if it's 5 minutes, with my green light space, and be intentional about that?
Oh, I love the way that you describe that. I wish we could go to Italy every day.
Same.
I mean, right? I'm like, that sounds amazing. Well, okay. So I feel like you've given us a lot to think about. And I really am finding a lot of, like, sort of boiling down this idea, right, of the red, yellow, green for somebody, for us, as a way to think about it. Instead of my joke is around self-care is always, we used to do a group session with a therapist when I was actively an advocate responding to the hospital for sexual violence survivors. And she asked us, like, what are you doing for self-care? And I was like, I'm going to learn to play the guitar. And she was like, no. We're not adding, right, to your plate. It's supposed to be something that you already do. So I think, you know, challenging people to think about, to your point, what is that thing that we already know connects us to the green light space, and not trying to add an additional piece to our plates.
I have four categories. What are the things that make me smile? What are the things that make me laugh? What are the things that calm me? What are the things that motivate or inspire me? Those are them. And I need five in each of these categories. So, and that becomes my toolkit.
I love that.
If I'm doing the things that I saw this person on Instagram posted that's what they're doing. That's what calms them. That's what motivates them. That's what resets them. My own things, my own unique things. And if it's coloring in a coloring book, then I need to go buy some crayons and coloring books, and I need to color 5 minutes a day.
Yeah. I think so many people don't spend the time to stop and think about what are those categories for them, right? Like, to your point, we spend a lot of time scrolling on Instagram and places and trying to adhere to other people's ideas of what green light should be. Well, this has been really incredible. And so the sort of one question that we're asking all of our guests this season as we wrap up is, if you were sort of giving an elevator speech, what's the one thing about trauma that the public might not know or understand that you would want them to?
In terms of, one, trauma is an umbrella term, and two people can have experienced the same traumatic event. One may develop a trauma response and one may not. And that is based off of what their history is, like what brought them to that space. One. Two, anytime two humans are interacting with each other, their pasts are having a present moment interaction. If we can remember that, it gives us the sort of allowance for grace. Why did they say that? Why did they do that? Why did that? That was their past having showing up right here, present day. And just to give folks grace, because we never, ever, ever know what is in that past.
That's so powerful. I'm having an emotive reaction because it's so true. Like every interaction is so much greater than us in that moment. And it's easy to get lost in that. Your work is just really impactful. And I'm so grateful for what you're doing in the world and for people, but communities too, and the ripple effect that helping one person heal has on so many others. And Dr. Jazz, I just want to thank you for the time, but also what you do every day outside of this conversation that you've had with us. And of course, to our listeners, we're so grateful for you joining us for season 4 of Trauma Ties. And as you listen to the season, be sure you can listen and also subscribe, rate, and review the Trauma Ties podcast wherever you go to listen.
And hopefully you will all join us for another season of More Untangling.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Jazz.
This episode of Traumatize is over, but this podcast is just one of our many resources. Volare welcomes all survivors of crime and their supporters. So please visit us at volare-empowers.org. to learn more about how to access our trauma education and how to partner with us to create empowering experiences for survivors.